Today is Monday, April 3rd. We're going to be working on spinal cord and brain information today. Okay, so we're going to review spinal cord cross-section first. A good reference point is a picture on the bottom of page 105. We're just going to draw it from scratch. And so if you have a piece of paper, maybe the back of a sheet of paper, we're just going to sketch that spinal cord cross-section. Probably one of the easiest things to do is give yourself something that looks like a butterfly or an H, and that's going to be the middle portion or the gray matter for our spinal cord. All you need is three bumps on each side, so that's kind of what we're going for here. We're going to put a hole in the center. So let's start with that hole in the center. That hole is actually where cerebrospinal fluid will circulate, and it's called the what? Central canal. Good. That hole is your central canal. Okay, and that butterfly or H-shaped structure is our gray matter. What you've got drawn, the whole thing is gray matter. The entire thing. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that gray matter is unmyelinated, and that means the nerve impulses travel slower. So no myelination means the nerve impulses here are slower. Gray matter has horns, so let's label the three horns. In this particular position, the dorsal or posterior horn is at the top of the picture. So we'll start there. The lateral horn is on the side. Each side has a lateral horn. And the portion of the horn closest to the anterior side is also called the ventral horn. So there are horns on the right side, there's horns on the left side. So, you know, if you want, you can label these others as dorsal horn, lateral horn, and ventral horn. But, you know, there's the same thing on both sides of this gray matter. Let's go ahead and jot down what each horn is responsible for doing. Let's start again with the dorsal horns at the back. Those dorsal horns house interneurons. Interneurons are the ones that communicate between incoming sensory and outgoing motor. Okay, so dorsal horns house interneurons. Keep in mind that interneurons are found only in your central nervous system. And of course, we're in the spinal cord, so that is the central nervous system. And interneurons communicate between incoming sensory and outgoing motor. I kind of think of them as the middleman that talks between two different neurons, so that's their job, is to negotiate between incoming sensory and outgoing motor neurons. All right, so the other two horns are involved in motor control. That lateral horn is involved in automatic motor control. We call it autonomic or visceral. Okay, so that lateral horn is involved in automatic or autonomic motor control. And what this means is we're talking about the control of certain types of muscles. Which type? Cardiac, yeah. Cardiac and smooth muscle, glands, all that originates with control here in those lateral horns. So we can jot that down as a reminder. So the lateral horn controls involuntary events. That's a good way to think of what automatic or autonomic is. It's involuntary events. We can't control cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, or glands. You know, you can't tell your pancreas to make and release, you know, insulin any more than you can tell your heart to beat faster. We have two motor control portions here, lateral horn and ventral horn. What type of motor control comes from your ventral horn? Skeletal muscle, yeah. Voluntary control of skeletal muscle. So when we control body parts that are under conscious control, we're going to call those somatic. That's by contrast different from autonomic. So somatic motor output involves voluntary control of things like skeletal muscles. I'll put up there voluntary and involuntary just to remind us that skeletal muscle is voluntarily controlled. Its motor control comes from that ventral horn. Cardiac, smooth muscle, and glands is under involuntary control, and that comes from that lateral horn. How about questions so far on these three horns of gray matter? Let's talk about the white matter. The white matter surrounds the gray matter in the spinal cord, and that white matter is myelinated, so that means the nerve impulses travel how?
Fast.
Fast, yeah. So let's draw in the white matter. Just like us, there's a crack in the back, okay? And so that's something to look for. In fact, there's a crack in the front too, so there's a little crack right there. Little crack right there. You'll never look at the spinal cord the same again, will you? So what we've now drawn in is white matter that surrounds the spinal cord. And this is the outermost portion. So we don't necessarily call the areas in the white matter horns. We have a different name for them. What is a different name? Columns. Yeah, columns in the white matter, horns in the gray matter. So once you figure out which is the back side versus which is the front side, it's pretty easy to say, okay, everything back here in the back portion is called a dorsal column. Where should we place lateral columns? on the sides, yeah. I don't have a lot of room, but over here would be a lateral column. I got more room on this side, so we can jot it down over here. Anywhere between my dotted lines, because above my dotted line is dorsal and below my dotted line is ventral. So yeah, anywhere in this whole area here. Same on both left and right sides. Put dotted lines up here for you. Hopefully that helps you see where the markations are. Anything up top here we consider a dorsal column. We've got laterals on each side, and we've got the ventral column down here on the bottom side. But you know, you've got to have a landmark to identify front from back. These columns carry ascending tracks and descending tracks. I'm not going to ask you which specific column is housing which specific track. We're just going to appreciate that the columns carry information either to the brain in ascending tracks or motor information from the brain in descending tracks. So just to repeat, the columns contain tracks. Those tracks take information to and from your brain. And of course, if you're talking about an ascending track, it is sensory to the brain. If it's descending, it comes from the brain down the spinal cord, and that would be motor in nature. So just to repeat, we've got in the white matter or columns these things called tracks, and they're specific pathways that take information to and from the brain. Ascending tracks take information to the brain. They are sensory in nature. Descending tracks take information from the brain down the spinal cord, and they're, of course, motor in nature. Yeah, all the way up to in here would be ventral. Yep, sure would. All right, let me just remind you that the word tract is another name for a group of neurons, and it specifically says to me, I am in the white matter. Okay, so when I hear the word tracts, it's like saying nerves. But we use that particular term, tracks, to imply that we're talking about a group of neurons in the white matter. Okay, tracks are neurons in the white matter. So what you're looking at right now is strictly central nervous system. You're just looking at the spinal cord, so we are only dealing with central nervous system right now. But what I'm going to do is draw in a spinal nerve, and of course that spinal nerve draws in the peripheral nervous system. So I just want to kind of clarify here that we're kind of mixing together the peripheral and the central nervous system. So let's do that. Let's draw in some spinal nerves and their roots. we know that there is a spinal nerve that branches into a dorsal root. It has a big knob on it.
My paper's not that big.
If you can get like that much of it, that's all you need. Oh, you got a big spinal cord.
Yeah,
because at this point we're not going to worry with that so much as the connection.
Okay, wait a
second. I need y'all a minute to catch up with me.
Draw a small one.
There we go.
Draw a smaller version.
You guys, and I thought, well, we could just draw it too, but that one is the one I was going to have you label.
The drawing really helps too.
Yeah. Anybody need her picture? Y'all good with your pictures?
I have a picture of it, so if anybody wants it, I'll take it to you.
Okay, everybody ready to roll? So we've got a spinal nerve drawn in here, and that is peripheral nervous system. So everything in black on here, you know, this stuff is all PNS. Okay, so this is all peripheral nervous system. You've got a spinal nerve here. Do you recall how many pairs of spinal nerves we've got? 31. We've got 31 pairs of spinal nerves. And each spinal nerve is considered to be a mixed nerve, meaning what?
That is sensory and motor.
Good, sensory and motor. So when you get close to the spinal cord, you know, when you're driving on a road like out front here of this building, you've got both to and go traffic traveling all right up next to each other. But if you get further into the downtown streets, you're going to encounter streets that are one way only. And that's what happens to the spinal nerve. It literally kind of branches into a one-way path. On the back side is a pathway that takes information into the spinal cord. Is that information sensory or motor in nature?
Sensory.
That's sensory, good. So let's label that as sensory coming in. Now you've got your landmark, because back here on this sensory or dorsal root, you have a little bulb, and that bulb is called the dorsal root what?
Ganglion.
Ganglion, good. And what does that ganglion house? Cell bodies of neurons. So that's just a little collection of cell bodies of neurons. So what comes into your spinal cord has to arrive there by way of a spinal nerve, and the spinal nerve, of course, branches into this dorsal root, and you not only have autonomic nerves carrying involuntary sensations there, stuff that you're not consciously aware of, you also have voluntary conscious awareness of, say, ooh, my muscles burn, I just walked, you know, four flights of stairs, or my joints really hurt. So you have both subconscious or unconscious and involuntary information traveling with voluntary information that you're aware of. So all of that info is housed on the dorsal root. It comes into the spinal cord, and the first stop that it makes is a set of interneurons in which horn?
Dorsal horn.
Dorsal horn, right. And then that dorsal horn says, hey, I just received your incoming information, and I'm going to decide how to sort that information. So that's kind of the place where decisions are made in your spinal cord. You know, do we need to handle this as a reflex and come right back out? Or does the brain need to know about this? At which point we're going to go across that central area near the great commissure and travel up to the spine and the opposite side of our white matter. That's kind of where we're heading today with this information. Let's go ahead and label the ventral root. The ventral root is this one on the bottom side. What type of information does it carry? Motor, good. Ventral root carries motor. So when you talk about controlling your body, you have both voluntary control over skeletal muscles and involuntary control over cardiac and smooth muscles. Both types of motor neurons are going to travel in that ventral root. And then when we join here and have the spinal nerve, we have a wrapping of epineurium that goes around the entire outside of that nerve. And so now you have what's classically considered a mixed nerve. It houses both sensory and motor information. And about this time, you're going to pass through an opening. That opening is the intervertebral foramen on the backside where you've got those vertebrae. And those spinal nerves sneak through that intervertebral foramen. All right, so at this point, do you have any questions about all the parts?
Did you say ventral root? What did you say? Go through that?
Ventral root is both somatic motor neurons, which control voluntary skeletal muscles, and also autonomic motor neurons, which controls cardiac and smooth muscles and glands.
And dorsal root is only
sensory, but it's somatic sensory, which you can sense and feel. It's also autonomic sensory, which you don't necessarily need to know about, you know, the vessel diameter or something of that sort.
So dorsal is only sensory, and ventral is motor and sensory.
Just sensory on dorsal, just motor on ventral. Maybe here, both motor and sensory, when they join, you've got both of them housed together inside that epineurium wrapping.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you have any questions on any part so far?
And it's the same on both sides.
Right? Same on both sides, that's right. So let's go back and do the example that we did in class last Wednesday. Last Wednesday, we were talking about placing your hand on a hot stove. If you place your hand on a hot stove, that information comes along the way of the dorsal root because that houses sensory information. And that information comes into your spinal cord and makes a pit stop at the dorsal horn. So at that point, your dorsal horn makes a decision. If you've got your hand laying on a hot stove, you don't have time to ride the elevator to your brain, let your brain make the decision. Let the decision come back down your spinal cord. So what we're going to use instead is called a reflex. So reflexes come into the spinal cord. They may or may not hit those interneurons, and then they reflex right back out the ventral root, which is motor information. So you're going to move your hand away from something that's painful without even processing it in your brain. Your spinal cord processes it. Now, your brain eventually figures out what's going on, because anything that comes in through your interneurons can be routed across that great commissure. That's this piece right here. Okay? And we use that as a gateway to the other side of the spinal cord. So what we're talking about now is called contralateral control. That means the left side of your nervous system controls the right side of your body and vice versa. So if you've just laid your hand on a hot stove, the information comes in the appropriate dorsal horn on that side of your body, but but we actually travel across the Great Commission, sure, and then we hit the appropriate ascending tract that goes up to your brain. So thinking back to last week, we talked about two types of ascending tracts, spinothalamic, and what was the other one?
Spinocerebellar.
Good, spinocerebellar. Which one carries pain and temperature to your brain?
Spinothalamic,
good. So that's how your brain eventually figures out that you just burned your hand. It takes about a second later for your brain to get the information. And we've all had that experience of going, oh man, that's gonna hurt. You wait for it and then boom, the information finally hits your brain. So it's having to travel over that white matter pathway. Even though it's myelinated, you still have to go up the spinal cord, hit the thalamus, and then relay out to the appropriate part of the brain. Do you see any advantage of contralateral control?
Yes.
What's the advantage of contralateral control?
Not getting burned.
And if you've burned the right side of your body, we hope that the left side of your spinal cord is still intact, and so we can still get the information to your brain. So it seems to be a self-preservation factor of having one side of your body controlled by the opposite side of your brain and spinal cord. Okay, so that is kind of where we were on Wednesday when we left class. Do y'all have any questions so far? Let's go back through and repeat ramus, okay? And then we're going to talk about plexuses. That'll be new for today. The word ramus is on the top of page 107. Top of page 107. Room now too, but I'll see what I can do with my little tiny bit of space over here. When these spinal nerves emerge through your intervertebral foramen, we're right up against your vertebrae at the back, but they're going to split once again, and the splits or branches are called a ramus. And each ramus is still considered to be a mixed nerve, meaning what?
It has motor and sensory.
Good, has motor and sensory. So you're going to split right away, and a piece will travel around to the front of your body. That will innervate the front side. We call that the ventral or anterior ramus. And a little piece branches and travels to the back side of your body, and we call that piece the posterior or dorsal ramus. So ramus is another word for a branch. It is a branch of your spinal nerve, and each branch is going to wrap and cover either the front of your body or the back side of your body. You know, we talked in class a little bit toward the end on Wednesday, you know, things like shingles, goodness, chicken pox, herpes virus, those types of viruses love to inflame our nerves, and what they'll do is they'll start back here in the dorsal root ganglion, and the inflammation travels out the spinal nerve, and it'll pick one of these rami to travel through. So if we can isolate and figure out where it's at, we can actually say, hey, you've got a inflammation in spinal nerve T11, and we'll follow it from the back side around to the front side. There's an old saying that goes, if you've got, say, shingles virus, if it ever wraps you, it will kill you. It's never going to come to the front and skip across your midline, because on each side, the ventral ramus starts at your spine, and then it wraps you and gives you a hug from behind, and all those rami meet along your midline. So it's never gonna hop across your midline and keep traveling. It starts at the back side and then wraps to the front side. So in fact, if someone does have inflammation along the same spinal nerve, it's gonna have to originate along the back side of their body. Okay, so how about questions on what a ramus is? If we map inflammation along a particular ramus, we call it a what? Dermatome. Good, dermatome. So dermatomes just map the location of spinal nerves, and we can track viruses and their inflammation in those dermatomes. So, if you think about the spinal cord, it has 31 pairs of spinal nerves. Let's say the one we drew here is like pair number T8. This is number T9. You keep going down, you've got all these spinal nerves that are branching off constantly. When they branch off, their branches can crisscross and lay over each other, and this creates a network. In fact, it creates a workaround in case you do have problems. I'm going to lower this and show you what a real plexus looks like. Okay, so a ramus is just simply a branch of a spinal nerve, but a plexus is a crisscrossing network of spinal nerves. So this gets to be a real mess in here. It becomes very difficult to follow one particular spinal nerve. You'll notice how they lay on top of each other, they crisscross, and in fact, they'll even pick up nerve impulses from other spinal nerves and transmit them either to the brain or from the brain. So that's intentional because now we have a backups plan. So if you've got damage to one particular ramus or a particular part of a plexus, you hopefully have a route that exists that can take information to or from the brain. So let me clarify the terms here. The word ramus means a branch of a spinal nerve. But on the top of page 108, you'll notice the word plexus there is a network of spinal nerves. A ramus is a branch. A plexus is a network. Okay, so a ramus is a branch and a plexus is a network. There's five main nerve plexuses I'd like to talk you through. For each main nerve plexus, there is a primary nerve of importance. So you'll want to know that nerve. It is in boldface on page 108. If you know your terms, then knowing where the plexus is located becomes pretty easy. For starters, we've got the cervical plexus, which is located in the neck region. And you'll notice what a mess this is of crisscrossing spinal nerves that come off in the cervical region. The important one we're going to work on, though, is the phrenic nerve. This phrenic nerve travels down each side of your neck. It innervates your diaphragm and intercostal muscles. It is one that's involved in making those muscles contract so you can breathe. Every year we hear unfortunate stories about people diving into swimming pools, breaking their necks, and drowning. And it is, in fact, the broken phrenic nerve that prevents the diaphragm and intercostal muscles from contracting. So that is a really important muscle that's found in the neck region that does help us innervate and make those muscles breathe for us, pull air into our lungs. All right, let's talk about the brachial plexus. Where is it located? Arm, good. Another real mess of crisscrossing networking nerves. These nerves travel from your armpit down your arm, and there's five important ones here. You have a musculocutaneous nerve that serves, guess what, muscles and skin. You have a median nerve, which travels all the way down to your fingers. You also have an ulnar and a radial nerve. Well, which side and anatomical position is your radius on? Thumb side, right? And ulnar nerve would be on the pinky side. So those nerves travel with the bones down your arm, and you can see they even innervate the hand. So for people who have, say, carpal tunnel syndrome and have tightening of the nerve sheaths around those neurons, we can actually figure out which particular neuron is being squeezed by saying, well, do you have problems in your pinky? Do you have problems in your index finger? Or is a problem over in your thumb? So that allows us to pinpoint exactly which neuron is probably causing problems down the arm. Okay, how about questions on the cervical or the brachial plexus? Interesting to note, if you damage the armpit area, which has got to be painful, you can damage the brachial plexus, and you'll notice this man can't raise his arm above, you know, kind of being almost horizontal there for the upper arm. So unfortunate problem can arise if you damage that plexus. You can end up causing damage to the rest of your arm, even down into your hand. Let's talk about the lumbar and the sacral plexuses. You'll notice the lumbar serves the front of the legs down to the feet. It involves the femoral nerve, which is found on the front side of your leg. The sacral plexus, however, is on the back side of your leg. And so if you have trouble keeping these two plexuses straight, keep in mind that the word sacral has an S in it. You sit on the sacral nerve. Okay, you sit on your sacral nerve. So these sacral nerves come out of your sacrum area, which is at the very bottom of your spinal cord, and these sacral nerves branch and go through your buttocks. What an unfortunate way for them to travel, because they do a lot. You know, they abduct, they move your thigh, and of course, they can also pinch off your nerves. There's a muscle deep to your gluteus muscles that can cause a pinching around your sacral nerves, and that can cause sciatica. So the sciatic nerve is the most important main branch off of your sacral nerve plexus, and it's the one that can be pinched by this little tiny muscle deep to your butt cheeks. So how unfortunate can that be? Well, if you squeeze and pinch that sciatic nerve, the damage can run all the way down the back of your leg, even to your ankle area. People who have numbness in their heel or tingling on the back of their legs, we trace that problem all the way back up to where that sciatic nerve branches off the plexus. And so you can see that's in the very lower back region. Sciatic nerve is one of the longest nerves in the body. It's interesting because it completely travels the back side of your leg. So if you do have damage done to that sciatic nerve, you can see the problems travel all the way the length of your leg. So if sacral nerve plexus serves the back side of your leg, what serves the front side? Lumbar, right? Lumbar is on the front. Sacral nerve plexus, along with the sciatic nerve, are on the back side of your leg. The solar nerve plexus is one that's internal. This one doesn't serve muscles necessarily. It more serves the digestive organs that are beneath your diaphragm. You know, when people get hit in the stomach region, it can knock the breath out of them because the solar nerve plexus can be stunned, and it sits up underneath the diaphragm where you're breathing. This solar nerve plexus also includes a very important member, and it's the vagus nerve. This vagus nerve is going to be one that is a cranial nerve, not a spinal nerve. So that's what makes our solar nerve plexus a little different. The vagus nerve travels from your brain all the way down into your abdomen, and it innervates organs like your stomach, even your kidneys, your uterus if you're female, bladder. So it travels quite a far away from your brain. So vagus nerve is the important member for our solar nerve plexus. Do you have questions on our major nerve plexuses and their major nerves?
Will you show us a picture, or will it just be definition-based?
It'll be definition-based here. So switching gears a little bit, we've talked about reflexes, but I'd like to kind of formally work you through them now. So they're on the bottom of your page. Reflex arcs. You'll notice the definition of a reflex. It's automatic, it's involuntary, it's predictable, and it's an automated response to a stimulus. Okay? Automatic, involuntary, it's a rapid, predictable response to a stimulus. So we're hardwired with certain types of reflexes. And you know what? You can even learn reflexes. Typing is a reflex. So eventually you don't even have to look at the keyboard. You don't even have to really think about what letter you're typing next. That is completely a learned reflex. So interesting that some reflexes, like typing, can be learned. Other interesting things about reflexes, things like walking are reflexive. When you walk, you reflexively swing your arms, and that's also hardwired to your brain. But if someone has a spinal cord injury and the spinal cord and brain no longer communicate, that person can relearn how to walk simply by training the spinal cord to have a reflex with walking. So it may take them months to relearn how to walk, But all we need to do is route a reflex through the spinal cord. It sounds really simple, doesn't it? To make that spinal cord learn, this is what happens when you do this, we want you to do that next. So reflexes are typically automatic, involuntary, they're rapid, predictable responses to a stimulus. So I'd like to take you through a typical reflex pathway. Pathways may be monosynaptic or polysynaptic. I know that word kind of sounds intimidating, but the word synapse is hidden in there, meaning what? Good, it's the space between neurons, right? Okay, and if you have one synapse, that means you have one neuron communicating to a neighboring neuron. What about a polysynaptic pathway?
Many,
yeah. So which one do you think would be faster, monosynaptic or polysynaptic?
Mono.
Mono, yeah, only one synapse you have to travel through. Polysynaptic pathways involve many neurons that you're going to have to synapse through. So what you're looking at here is in fact a polysynaptic pathway. This polysynaptic pathway involves a stimulus. I think most of us would agree that getting poked with a pen is not a pleasant feature. If you get poked with a pen, you're gonna draw your finger back away. You'll notice a stimulus comes in the dorsal root. What type of information is carried in the dorsal root? Yeah, sensory. You notice we make a pit stop here in that interneuron. That interneuron says, ouch, you just poked me with the pin. What should I do? Move the motor skill, move it back. So you'll notice there's one synapse there. We synapse again down here at your ventral root. What type of motor neurons are housed there? Somatic, yeah. So that's skeletal muscle movement. And then we come right back out the ventral root, back out to a set of muscles. And those muscles will, of course, contract and move your arm away from that point of a stimulus. Notice in this reflex arc, it is completely automatic, and this particular type of spinal nerve reflex does not involve your brain. Your brain's going to know what happened. We're eventually going to travel across the gray commissure. We're going to hit an ascending track, and we're going to travel up to the brain and tattletale to the brain what we just did. But in order to move your hand away from the stimulus, notice there was no brain involvement. All we did was come into the spinal cord. The spinal cord made the decision, and we went right back out a motor neuron to move that muscle. So that's the thing with reflexes. If you're talking about spinal nerve reflexes, you don't have to involve the brain. So you will eventually tell the brain what's happening, but in order to make the reflex happen, brain involvement's not required. Okay, so the difference between mono and polysynaptic reflexes, of course, is how many synapses you must travel through. Notice that monosynaptic pathways don't actually involve an interneuron. The polysynaptic pathways do involve an interneuron. Like you told me earlier, which one is faster?
Monosynaptic.
Yeah, monosynaptic. Why is that?
Because only
has
one synapse.
One synapse, that's right. Okay, so with monosynaptic pathways, this reflex involves a sensory neuron talking directly to a motor neuron. We don't even waste time talking to an interneuron. It's a direct connection coming in and going right back out the spinal nerve. Now, with a polysynaptic neuron, it's still fast. It's faster than having to go to your brain for a discussion and back down your spinal cord. But still, there are multiple synapses involved in a polysynaptic reflex. So above the little chart on the bottom of your page, I've got two questions for you. With the general pathway of a polysynaptic reflex, you're noticing that we come in through a sensory neuron, dendrites to the cell body in the dorsal root ganglion, right into the interneuron in the spinal cord, and then right back out a motor neuron. But notice, what part of the nervous system did we completely bypass? Brain, yeah, completely bypass the brain. The second question says, what part of the polysynaptic pathway is missing from a monosynaptic pathway? Yeah, interneuron, that's right. Okay, so the part of the pathway missing from the monosynaptic pathway, there is no interneuron. Thanks. Mono with the fastest, that's right. I'd like to work you through an example of a monosynaptic pathway. Keep in mind, this is simply a sensory neuron talking directly to what? Motor, yeah. Notice there is no interneuron involved in a monosynaptic pathway. We come in, we bypass the interneuron up there. It's like, hey, sorry, we don't have time for you, interneuron. We come right on down to the motor neuron and we come right back out. I do want you to notice, though, that we're working with skeletal muscle and we're talking to a motor neuron in the ventral horn of the gray matter. So why that particular horn? Why not the lateral horn? Exactly. We're not talking to heart muscle, we're not talking to smooth muscle, we're not talking to glands. If we're talking to skeletal muscles, we have to come out through that ventral horn of the gray matter. So you'll notice we come in with a sensory neuron, we don't even stop at the interneuron back up there at the dorsal horn. We link directly with the motor neuron sitting down in the ventral horn, and we come right back out the spinal nerve. So this particular reflex is called a stretch reflex. So imagine if you're standing on a curb, you know, getting ready to step off, and you're stretching your muscles, or perhaps if you're standing on a ladder, stretching your muscles. Anytime you're standing, excuse me, in an awkward position where you may be stretching your muscles, especially those in your leg, if you continue to stretch and stretch those muscles, what may happen to them?
Tear.
Yeah. So if you continue to stretch, the risk you run is tearing that muscle. Thinking back, way back, when we talked about how long it takes to heal certain tissue types, was skeletal muscle on the fast or the slow healing list?
Slow.
Yeah, so if you tear skeletal muscle, you're looking at a very long heal rate, and so therefore we don't want to tear skeletal muscle. What we do want to do, though, is have a reflex that prevents us from tearing that muscle. So if you're standing in a position where you're stretching and stretching and stretching those muscles, you don't want to have them tear, so the reflex makes them contract. So you'll notice that the activation of the motor neuron during an overstretching event makes those muscles contract back. You ever get a Charlie horse? Where do you get it? Calf muscle. Do you ever get it when you're sleeping in the bed and stretching your legs? There you go. If you keep stretching your legs, especially when you're sleeping, that reflex says, oh no, you don't, you're gonna overstretch me and rip that calf muscle. At least that's what the reflex says. And of course, that's gonna make you automatically contract, and boy, it contracts with a vengeance, right? There comes that Charlie horse, that cramp that sets in. So that's a good example of how the stretch reflex is supposed to work. It doesn't feel good to us, but it keeps your muscles from tearing. Okay, let's talk about the knee-jerk reflex. It's also monosynaptic, or at least part of it is. You ever had one of these knee-jerk reflexes tested at the doctor's office? It's really uncomfortable, isn't it? It's like, you know, they touch a certain part of your patella. In fact, if they strike the patellar ligament, then you automatically swing and kick. And when you swing and kick, what's happened is you've created a reflex arc that comes to the spinal cord and back out. Notice there's two pathways here. The information that comes in splits. This pathway with the green neuron, that involves an interneuron. Is that one mono or polysynaptic?
Poly.
Poly, yeah. So the one we're going to follow has no green interneuron. It comes right here and connects up to a motor neuron, and then we swoop right back out to the quadriceps. And when your quadriceps contract, what happens to your leg? kicks out. Yeah, it extends your leg, you kick out, and of course, that's part of the reflex. You'll notice the knee-jerk response is partly monosynaptic, it's partly polysynaptic, but it gets the job done. You end up swinging your leg and kicking anytime you strike the patellar ligament. Okay, so to summarize, the monosynaptic reflexes involve how many neurons? Motor and sensory. So there's actually just two in there, right? And one synapse exists between those two. Is there an interneuron involved in your typical monosynaptic pathway? No. So no interneurons involved here. They're really fast because you don't have to slow down to talk to those interneurons. Let's compare that with a polysynaptic pathway. I think right off the bat, looking at the picture, compare this nice, clean, simple stretch reflex with this messy diagram for a polysynaptic withdrawal reflex. All of this conversation going on in here is involving interneurons. It is still a fast reflex, but you're coming in from sensory. You're talking to interneurons in here, and then you're going back out a motor pathway. So still fast, it just involves multiple polysynapses to get the reflex to work. Okay, so what is one of our classic polysynaptic reflexes? What is this one?
Hot stove.
Hot stove, yeah. Stump your toe, step on a sharp pin, poke yourself with something sharp, put your hand on a hot stove. We are going to reflexively draw back, and that's called a flexor reflex because you're bending your body part. And of course, you know, that's also known as a withdrawal reflex. You're going to withdraw your body part from the painful stimulus. The other reflex I'd like to show you is this tendon reflex, and I actually didn't draw it very well. It is a polysynaptic reflex, but if you look at that picture, it really looks more like a monosynaptic reflex. But it is polysynaptic, and this particular reflex is involved with your tendons. So if you've ever been carrying, say, a heavy, heavy box, and you've got a long way to walk with that heavy box, you're pretty good to start off with. You're like, yeah, I think I can make it. Yeah, I'm good, and then about halfway there, you're like, oh, I'm getting tired, I'm going to have to put this down, and oh no, I think I'm going to drop it, can you help me? And then all of a sudden your muscles fail. What is set into play here is called a tendon reflex. So if you're carrying a very heavy load, you'll notice that these tendons are supporting the weight. And what do tendons anchor muscles to? Bone. Yeah. If you're carrying a very heavy load, what could potentially happen to those tendons?
They tear,
right. And of course, they're on the short list of muscles and other things that heal slowly. We could add tendons there. So if you tear a tendon, you're also looking at a very slow heal rate. So we don't want to tear the tendon. This reflex says to your muscles, let go. And what does that do for your tendon? It relaxes it, yeah. So when you're carrying a very heavy load and you run the risk of ripping your tendon reflex is a polysynaptic pathway that tells you to let go of the load and relax. So anytime you're carrying something overly heavy, that's what's going to happen. You simply have a tendon reflex set up to prevent your tendons from tearing. How about questions on poly and monosynaptic reflex pathways? Charlie horse. It's over, like if you're stretching your legs in the bed, and as soon as you hit that reflex where you think your body thinks you're gonna tear that muscle, then the automatic response is not to stretch further but to contract it back. Stretch reflex makes you contract, tendon reflex makes you relax. So they're actually opposite reflexes. Did you not get it? Okay, I'll get it back there to you. All right, so how about page 110? Let's get on the parade there. wants me to sign in today. All right, so we're going to look at the brain a little bit. We've spent some time with spinal cord and spinal nerves. The brain is part of which nervous system?
CNS,
good. So we know the brain, like the spinal cord, has coverings that provide protection. We know the skull provides protection over the brain, as does the vertebrae for the spinal cord. We've got the same setup here. We've already talked about this. We've got three meninges, or membrane layers, covering over the brain and spinal cord. We've got dura mater, which is a tough, leathery outer covering, a spider web-like arachnoid matter in the middle, and then where do you find pia mater? Covering the brain, yeah, it's like shrink wrap on the brain, okay? So this graphic kind of helps you understand the whole covering. Skin, of course, on the outside forms your scalp. Then we have bone. Attached to your bone is dura mater. Notice this spider web-like stuff. That's all the arachnoid matter. And that pia mater is like shrink wrap. It's directly adhered to the brain itself, and it's most tightly covering the brain surface. It is a soft outer layer for that brain. So on the right-hand side of this brain, you can notice something that looks kind of like wax paper. That's the dura mater covering the right-hand side of the brain. On the left side, they removed the dura mater, and what you may see there is something shiny. That's going to be the pia mater directly covering the brain tissue. You can't actually remove the pia mater without picking away brain tissue up underneath, because that pia mater is so tightly adhered to the underlying tissue. All right, so just another look here. There is that spider web-like arachnoid matter that separates dura mater on the outside from pia mater underneath. So which of these three layers experiences the circulation of cerebrospinal fluid? Arachnoid, good. That arachnoid matter has the fluid circulating through it, good. Okay. Let's see. Let's talk also about the dura mater folds near the top of your page. You probably have seen these in lab looking at the brain. There are fissures in the brain, which are cracks, so to speak. And looking from the top-down view, you're noticing that there are two halves to the cerebrum. And the fissure running between those two is called the longitudinal fissure. Okay? And in this picture, you may be able to see a little bit of a blood vessel laying in that longitudinal fissure. That blood vessel is a vein. It's a really big vein, and so we call it a superior sagittal sinus. So I don't want you to think sinus is like the ones that produce mucus in your face. Sinus can also mean a large blood vessel, either an artery or a vein, but these are veins in the brain, superior sagittal sinus. Also from this back view, we can notice there is a horizontal fissure separating your cerebrum up here from your cerebellum down below. This horizontal fissure running across is called your transverse fissure. There's another blood vessel hiding in this fold of dura mater. What's the name of this blood vessel?
Transverse
sinus, good. Let me put it to you this way. The dura mater creeps into the fold just like a wedgie, and in the wedgie fold is where the blood vessel lays. So if you were to peel that dura mater fold up, you would notice it would have actually created a wedge down in the fissure, and then the little blood vessel lays right in there like a little river running through the fissures. So superior sagittal sinus is laying in the longitudinal fissure. Transverse sinus lays back there in that transverse fissure. So just kind of the naming scheme there kind of works in terms of how they've laid it out. Do you have questions so far? So let me talk to you about halfway down the page with cerebrospinal fluid. CSF for short is cerebrospinal fluid. I need to kind of give you a sneak preview into Bio-211 territory. So do you know what is found in blood? Good. Plasma. Good. Blood cells are there too, but we don't want the blood cells right now. We just are after the blood plasma. So in your brain, we have an area where we don't let the blood and the brain tissue communicate directly. Instead, we allow for communication between blood plasma and the brain tissue. So what we're going to do in these areas called choroid plexuses is squeeze out of the blood just the blood plasma. We don't want the blood cells. They can stay in the bloodstream. We're going to take out only the blood plasma. So you'll notice here that we're going to filter out of these blood vessels glucose. Why would we want to take glucose out for the brain tissue? It's sugar. It makes ATP, right? Oxygen certainly is needed to make ATP. We'll give vitamins and ions to the brain tissue to be able to function. So we're going to squeeze these good things out of the bloodstream, and we're going to allow for the brain tissue to have access to these items here. So this setup that you're looking at is rather strange. It's a knot of capillaries called a choroid plexus. You'll notice lining them are specialized cells with cilia on top. Thinking back to when we talked about neurons and neuroglia, what type of special neuroglial cell has cilia in the brain? Ependymal cells ring a bell? Yeah, that's an ependymal cell lining that choroid plexus. They're ciliated, and they're going to sweep along and help to create the cerebrospinal fluid. So what they call filtrate here is, in fact, cerebrospinal fluid, and these ependymal cells are helping to move that fluid out of the bloodstream and into circulation around the brain and spinal cord. So let's get you a different picture to look at. How about this one? You've got a couple of places where you can find this happening, where you're squeezing out the blood plasma from the blood. This one here is situated around your third and lateral ventricles. You've got another choroid plexus down here by your fourth ventricle. And so these are locations where we've got like springs that have popped up, and we're squeezing out blood plasma from the bloodstream. And what we're doing is we're circulating that blood plasma as cerebrospinal fluid. So I'd like to take you on a tour of circulation, and we're just going to pick a starting point over on the next page. What's that? Yeah, sure. Okay. I'm going to take you on a tour of CSF. We're going to work it through from a point of formation at one of these choroid plexuses. We're going to pick the one situated here by your third and lateral ventricles. But you know, the brain looks different depending on how you orient it. So we're going to start with that choroid plexus. We're going to squeeze fluid out of your bloodstream, and we're going to call that fluid cerebrospinal fluid. So let me turn the brain a different way. In this particular perspective, you can see that when you're in the lateral ventricles, they coil like horns into each one of our cerebral hemispheres, okay? So we're actually inside one of these coiled lateral ventricles, and we're gonna make the cerebrospinal fluid by squeezing plasma across the walls of those tiny choroid plexus vessels. So these lateral ventricles fill with fluid. We call that CSF. That fluid drains from each lateral ventricle to a very tiny hole here in the middle called an interventricular foramen. The old name for it is foramen of Monroe. In anatomy, they're trying to get away from naming stuff after people, but nonetheless, interventricular foramen and foramen of Monroe are the very same opening between your two ventricles. From that little tiny foramen, we're going to travel through the third ventricle between your two hemispheres and down through a very skinny pathway called the cerebral aqueduct. As you come on down, we find a diamond-shaped fourth ventricle, and then we leak on down the central canal. Before we finish it, let's do it from the top one more time. Cerebrospinal fluid is formed by choroid plexuses. We're going to pick a set that's in the lateral ventricles. From the lateral ventricles, we're going to travel toward an opening called the interventricular foramen. Where do we go next?
Third ventricle,
good. And into a very skinny pathway called cerebral aqueduct. And then where? Good. Fourth ventricle. It looks like a diamond. And then you keep on going down toward the central canal. Okay. So, lateral ventricle, interventricular foramen, third ventricle, cerebral aqueduct, fourth ventricle, central canal. Notice, whoever named this could not count. There is no first or second ventricle. There's just laterals, third, then fourth. Okay? So laterals to the hole, third ventricle to the cerebral aqueduct, fourth ventricle to the central canal. So you'll notice that we're alternating a ventricle with another location. Let's see. Right about here is the central canal. That is in the inside of your gray matter. And we lose the spinal cord because it terminates around which vertebrae? L1, L2. Yes, so we're going to terminate the spinal cord. And at that point, the CSF drips from the end of the spinal cord out into the subarachnoid space. And now it's outside your spinal cord, traveling back up. It travels outside your brain as well. It travels around the arachnoid space of your brain. And then, eventually, we reabsorb it because we're going to exchange all that good stuff like glucose and oxygen for waste products like CO2. Let's close in here on this close-up. Notice this arachnoid layer has a little bubbly out pocket there. That little bubble is called an arachnoid granulation, or sometimes they'll refer to it like as an arachnoid villus. That is where we start to reabsorb the cerebrospinal fluid back into one of these big vessels. What is the name of the vessel laying in your longitudinal fissure? There you go, superior sagittal sinus. What about the one between cerebrum and cerebellum at the back running horizontal? Transverse, right. Those are called dural sinuses because they lay in the folds of dura mater, and that's where we reabsorb the waste products from circulation. Once you're back into the veins, these veins will ultimately take the blood back to the heart, and then we can start the whole process over after circulation returns blood back to the head.
So arachnoid absorbs the cerebrospinal fluid.
Correct. And takes it back to the veins, right. One more time from the top. We know that cerebrospinal fluid is made in choroid plexuses around your brain. We're going to pick the set in your lateral ventricles, make that our starting point. From the lateral ventricles, we travel through a tiny opening. That's called the interventricular foramen. Where do we go next?
Third.
And then where?
Cerebral aqueduct.
Good. And then where?
Fourth ventricle.
Fourth ventricle, and then down through an opening in the spinal cord called?
Central canal.
Good. All the way to the bottom, and then where's next?
Subarachnoid
space. We travel around the outside of spinal cord and brain, and then we're reabsorbed where? Good. Arachnoid granulations or villi, and that takes us back into a blood vessel. We generally call them dural sinuses. So now we're back in the bloodstream, and of course, we've now picked up waste products that we're going to carry off and back to the heart. Let me synthesize, there's something good about this circulation. There's also something bad about this. This is good because you can prevent most dangerous items from reaching your brain, like bacteria or viruses or other items that could cause harm. But the bad side is what? You can't get medicine to the brain. It's difficult to craft medicine that passes through this circulation pattern and then can affect your brain tissue. So in order to reach the brain tissue, we're looking at items that are typically lipid-based because lipids can pass directly across phospholipid bilayers. So that's the trick here, is this circulation pattern is saving the brain from a lot of infection, but then there's, of course, the downside to it. Let's see, where we're going to go on Wednesday is over to page 112. I encourage you to read ahead and look ahead at the chart on 113. There's a picture that we're going to label, and that picture is over on page 115. If you want an extra picture, you may want to print one and bring it. We're not going to draw that one together on Wednesday, but we'll just label the one that's in your course pack. All right, I'll see y'all on Wednesday.